That is why Freud had to fight against yielding. He risked effacing his whole identity. He was spinning his own web. How could he suspend himself in someone else's? It was Rank, more than anyone, who understood the problem of mere mortals who are saddled with the works of genius. Where are they to get the support for their own daring and overshadowing creations? We will see Rank's views in the next chapter. Here it is already obvious that Freud chose to pursue his causa sui project by using his own work and his own organization, the psychoanalytic movement, as a mirror to reflect power back upon himself. We said earlier that the causa sui project is a lie that must take its toll. Now we can understand that this toll is an emotional one that must always carry both the temptation to admit helpless dependence and the fight against that admission. One lives with a certain amount of tight-lipped determination. Note: Erich Fromm, in his important discussion of Freud's character, also fixes on helplessness and dependency as the underside of Freud, and so also confirms Jones. But Fromm seems to me to accent it too much as an ambivalent reflex of Freud's childhood relationship to his mother, whereas I am seeing it more as a universal phenomenon reacting to Freud's distinctive heroic ambition and burdens. See Fromm, Sigmund Freud's Mission, Chapter 5. End of note. There is further support for this view in Freud's 15-year relationship with Fleiss. Brohm is of the opinion that this relationship was an emotional one, more powerful than any previous biographer has acknowledged, and he cites Freud's own admissions of his very profound and obscure feelings in relation to Fleiss. It is more than a coincidence, then, that years earlier, Freud had suffered symptoms in relationship to Fleiss similar to those he suffered toward Jung, and in the very same room of the same hotel as at the 1912 meeting. At that earlier time, the symptoms were not so intense, and they were directed not toward a strong opposing figure, but toward an ailing Fleiss. When Freud analyzed this, he said that there was some piece of unruly homosexual feeling at the root of the matter. Jones reports that Freud several times remarked on the feminine side of his nature. Even though Freud's self-analytic honesty was unusual, we still have to be skeptical about it. It is possible for any man to have specific homosexual urges, and Freud need be no exception. Still knowing Freud's lifelong tendency to reduce vaguely anxious feelings to specific sexual motivations, we are entitled to assume that his unruly urges could just as well have represented the ambivalence of dependency needs. Jones himself has honestly averaged the problem of homosexuality into his appraisal of Freud's character, and I think gave it its proper weight. Jones says that this was part of the underside of dependency in Freud, a dependency that led him astray in some ways, for example, in his tendency to overestimate certain people, Breuer, especially Fleiss, and also Jung. Jones goes so far as to say that this side of Freud stemmed from some impairment of self-confidence. Certainly, Freud loathed this side of his nature, and welcomed the self-dependence he earned when a part of his homosexual dependency was revealed for the weakness that it was. He wrote to Ferenczi on October 6, 1910, that he had overcome the passivity he experienced toward Fleiss, and that he no longer had any need to uncover his personality completely. Since Fleiss's case, that need has been extinguished. A part of homosexual cathexis has been withdrawn, and made use of to enlarge my ego. The ego is the thing. It alone gives self-governance. The ability to have a certain freedom of action and choice to shape one's own destiny as much as possible. Today, we generally see homosexuality as a broad problem of ineptness, vague identity, passivity, helplessness, all in all, an inability to take a powerful stance toward life. In this sense, Jones would be right to talk about an impairment of self-confidence in Freud, as he showed it both toward the strong figure of Jung and the ailing one of Fleiss. In both cases, it is one's own strength that is threatened with an added burden. On the other hand, our modern understanding of homosexuality goes to an even deeper level of the problem, to the level of immortality and heroism that we have already discussed in relation to Freud and to genius in general. Rank wrote about this subject brilliantly. We will want to talk about his work in Chapter 10, but we need to linger on it here in specific relation to Freud. We said that the truly gifted and free spirit attempts to bypass the family as the instrument of distinctive procreation. It is only logical, then, that if the genius is going to follow to the letter the causa sui project, he comes up against one large temptation, to bypass the woman and the species role of his own body. It is as though he reasons, I do not exist to be used as an instrument of physical procreation in the interests of the race. My individuality is so total and integral that I include my body in my causa sui project. And so the genius can try to procreate himself spiritually through a linkage with gifted young men, to create them in his own image, and to pass the spirit of his genius on to them. It is as though he were to try to duplicate himself exactly, spirit and body. After all, anything that detracts from the free flight of one's spiritual talent must seem debasing. The woman is already a threat to the man in his physicalness. It is only a small step to bypass sexual intercourse with her. In that way, one keeps one's carefully girded center from dispersing and being undermined by ambiguous meanings. Most men are content to keep their meanings firmly in hand by refraining from extramarital infidelity. But one can narcissistically harbor his meanings even more by refraining from heterosexual infidelity, so to speak. From this point of view, when Freud talked about the feminine side of his nature, he could just as well have been speaking from the strength of his ego rather than its weakness, from his own single-minded determination to engineer his own immortality. It is common knowledge that sexual relations between Freud and his wife came to an end around the age of 41, and that he was strictly monogamous so far as we know. This behavior would be all of a piece with his causa sui project. The narcissistic self-inflation that denies dependency on the female body and on one's species-given role and the control and harboring of the power and meaning of one's individuality. As Rosen points out, in Freud's own words, he saw his hero as a man whose sexual need and activity were exceptionally reduced, as if a higher aspiration had raised him above the common animal need of mankind. Evidently, Freud poured his whole passion into the psychoanalytic movement and his own immortality. They were his higher aspiration, which could also reasonably include a spiritual homosexuality that offered no threat as an animal need. The conceptual ambivalence of causa sui. So far, we have been talking about emotional ambivalence, but there is also a conceptual side to the matter. It is one thing to face up to and admit an emotional reaction to the experience of fading away. It is still another thing to justify that fading. Freud could admit dependency and helplessness, but how give his own death any meaning? He either had to justify it from within his causa sui project, the psychoanalytic movement, or somewhat from outside that project. Here is the ambivalence of causa sui on a conceptual level. How can one trust any meanings that are not man-made? These are the only meanings that we securely know. Nature seems unconcerned, even viciously antagonistic to human meanings. And we fight by trying to bring our own dependable meanings into the world. But human meanings are fragile, ephemeral. They are constantly being discredited by historical events and natural calamities. One Hitler can efface centuries of scientific and religious meanings. One earthquake can negate a million times the meaning of a personal life. Mankind has reacted by trying to secure human meanings from beyond. Man's best efforts seem utterly fallible without appeal to something higher for justification. Some conceptual support for the meaning of one's life from a transcendental dimension of some kind. As this belief has to absorb man's basic terror, it cannot be merely abstract, but must be rooted in the emotions, in an inner feeling that one is secure in something stronger, larger, more important than one's own strength in life. It is as though one were to say, "My life pulse ebbs, I fade away into oblivion, but God, or it, remains, even grows more glorious with and through my living sacrifice." At least this feeling is belief at its most effective for the individual. The problem of how far a life has to reach to earn secure heroic meaning obviously bothered Freud very much. According to psychoanalytic theory, the child meets the terror of life and aloneness first by asserting his own omnipotence, and then by using the cultural morality as the vehicle for his immortality. By the time we grow up, this confident delegated immortality becomes a major defense in the service of the equanimity of our organism in the face of danger. One of the main reasons that it is so easy to march men off to war is that deep down, each of them feels sorry for the man next to him who will die. Each protects himself and his fantasy until the shock that he is bleeding. It is logical that if you are one of the few who admits the anxiety of death, then you must question the fantasy of immortality, which is exactly the experience of Freud. Zilborg affirms that the problem troubled Freud all his life. He yearned for fame, anticipated it, hoped that through it he could create his own immortality. Immortality means being loved by many anonymous people. This definition is the Enlightenment view of immortality, living in the esteem of men yet unborn, for the works that you have contributed to their life and betterment. But it is an entirely this-worldly immortality. There's the rub. It must have rubbed Freud very gratingly. His views on immortality were charged with a severe ambivalence, even multivalence. Even early in life, he told his fiancée that he had destroyed all the letters he had received, adding ironically and triumphantly that his future biographers would be hard put to find data about him after he had gone from this earth. Later in life, he said a similar thing about his letters to Fleiss. If he had gotten hold of them instead of one of his disciples, he would have destroyed them rather than letting so-called posterity have them. Zilborg seems to think that this oscillation between desire for immortality and scorn for it reflects Freud's unfortunate habit of forming polarities in his thought. But to me it seems like more magical toying with reality. As you fear that life in this dimension may not count, may not have any real meaning, you relieve your anxiety by being especially scornful of the very thing that you wish for most, while underneath your writing desk you have your fingers crossed. On the one hand, you make psychoanalysis your private religion, your own royal road to immortality. On the other, you are unique and isolated enough to question the whole career of man on this planet. At the same time, you cannot abandon the project of your own creation of immortality, because the religious promise of immortality is a pure illusion, fit for children and for the credulous man in the street. Freud was in this terrible bind, as he confessed to the Reverend Oscar Pfister. I can imagine that several million years ago, in the Triassic Age, all the great Odons and Therias were very proud of the development of the Saurian race, and looked forward to heaven knows what magnificent future for themselves. And then, with the exception of the wretched crocodile, they all died out. You will object that man is equipped with mind, which gives him the right to think about and believe in his future. Now there is certainly something special about mind. So little is known about it and its relation to nature. I personally have a vast respect for mind, but as nature, mind is only a little bit of nature, the rest of which seems to be able to get along very well without it. Will it really allow itself to be influenced to any great extent by regard for mind? Enviable he who can feel more confident about that than I. It is hard for a man to work steadfastly when his work can mean no more than the digestive noises, wind breakings, and cries of dinosaurs, noises now silenced forever. Or perhaps one works all the harder to defy the callous unconcern of nature. In that way, one might even compel her to defer to the products of mysterious mind by making words and thoughts an unshakable monument to man's honesty about his condition. This is what makes man strong and true, that he defies the illusory comforts of religion. Human illusions prove that men do not deserve any better than oblivion. So Freud must have reasoned, as he made psychoanalysis the competitor of religion. Psychoanalytic science would establish the true facts of the moral world and would reform it, if anything could. We see why psychoanalysis itself was a religion for Freud, as so many authoritative thinkers from Jung and Rank to Zilborg and Rief have remarked. All this can be put another way, that Freud set out to defy nature by redoubling his efforts to make true the lie of causa sui. Zilborg, in his penetrating assessment of Freud and religion, closed on these remarks. Ever since man started his so-called conquest of nature, he has tried to fancy himself the conqueror of the universe. In order to assure himself of the mastery of a conqueror, he grabbed the trophy, nature, universe. He had to feel that the maker of the trophy was annihilated, or his own fantasied sovereignty over the universe would be endangered. It is this trend that is reflected in Freud's unwillingness to accept religious faith in its true meaning. It is no surprise, therefore, to find that in the field of human psychology a man, no matter how great, a man like Freud, had constantly before him the vision of a man who was always unhappy, helpless, anxious, bitter, looking into nothingness with fright, and turning away from so-called posterity in anticipatory disgust. Zilborg says that Freud was driven into a rigid, almost solipsistic intellectual attitude by his need to rid himself of any suspicion of intellectual dependence on others or spiritual dependence on a personal god. The lie of causae sui becomes especially driven because of what one will not or cannot acknowledge. Then the very truth with which one seeks to defy nature suffers. Jung, who would agree with Zilborg, offers what to me seems the briefest and most apt summary of Freud's characterological life problem. Freud never asked himself why he was compelled to talk continually of sex, why this idea had taken such possession of him. He remained unaware that his monotony of interpretation expressed a flight from himself, or from that other side of him which might perhaps be called mystical. So long as he refused to acknowledge that side, he could never be reconciled with himself. There was nothing to be done about this one-sidedness of Freud's. Perhaps some inner experience of his own might have opened his eyes. He remained the victim of the one aspect he could recognize, and for that reason I see him as a tragic figure. For he was a great man, and what is more, a man in the grip of his daimon. What actually does it mean to be a tragic figure firmly in the grip of one's daimon? It means to possess great talent, to relentlessly pursue the expression of that talent through the unswerving affirmation of the causa sui project that alone gives it birth and form. One is consumed by what he must do to express his gift. The passion of his character becomes inseparable from his dogma. Jung says the same thing beautifully when he concludes that Freud must himself be so profoundly affected by the power of Eros that he actually wishes to elevate it into a dogma, like a religious Newman. Eros is precisely the natural energy of the child's organism that will not let him rest, that keeps propelling him forward in a driven way while he fashions the lie of his character, which ironically permits that very drivenness to continue, but now under the illusion of self-control. Conclusion. Now as we draw the circle on the very beginning of our discussion of Freud, we can see that his two great reluctances, as we have called them, are related, and in fact merge into one. On the one hand, he refused to move away cleanly from his instinct theory to the more blanket idea of a death fear. In the second place, he refused to move into a yielding posture toward external nature. He was unable to give large expression to the mystical, dependent side of himself. It seems to me that the two reluctances are related in his refusal to abandon the causa sui project, which would have led to a larger problematic view of human creatureliness. But such a view is the seeding ground of faith, or at least brings the person right up to faith, as an experiential reality and not an illusion. Freud never allowed himself to step upon this ground. Eros is a narrowing down in Freud of a broader experiential horizon. Or, put another way, in order to move from scientific creatureliness to religious creatureliness, the terror of death would have to replace sex, and inner passivity would have to replace obsessive eros, the drive of the creature. And it was just this twofold yielding, inner emotional and conceptual, that Freud could not quite manage, for to do so, as Jung judged with understanding, would mean to abandon his own daimon, his whole unique passion as a genius, the very gift that he had fashioned for mankind. Part 2. The Failures of Heroism. Neurosis and psychosis are modes of expression for human beings who have lost courage. Anyone who has acquired this much insight will thenceforth refrain from undertaking with persons in this state of discouragement tedious excursions into mysterious regions of the psyche. Alfred Adler. Chapter 7. The Spell Cast by Persons. The Nexus of Unfreedom. Ah, mon cher, for anyone who is alone without God and without a master, the weight of days is dreadful. Hence, one must choose a master, God being out of style. Albert Camus. Men incapable of liberty, who cannot stand the terror of the sacred that manifests itself before their open eyes, must turn to mystery, must hide the truth. Carlo Levi. For ages men have reproached themselves for their folly, that they gave their loyalty to this one or that, that they believed so blindly and obeyed so willingly. When men snap out of a spell that has very nearly destroyed them and muse on it, it doesn't seem to make sense. How can a mature man be so fascinated, and why? We know that all through history, masses have followed leaders because of the magic aura they projected, because they seemed larger than life. On the surface, this explanation seems enough, because it is reasonable and true to fact. Men worship and fear power, and so give their loyalty to those who dispense it. But this touches only the surface and is besides too practical. Men don't become slaves out of mere calculating self-interest. The slavishness is in the soul, as Gorky complained. The thing that has to be explained in human relations is precisely the fascination of the person who holds or symbolizes power. There is something about him that seems to radiate out to others and to melt them into his aura, a fascinating effect, as Christine Olden called it, of the narcissistic personality, or, as Jung preferred to call him, the mana personality. But people don't actually radiate blue or golden auras. The mana personality may try to work up a gleam in his eye or a special mystification of painted signs on his forehead, a costume, and a way of holding himself. But he is still Homo sapiens, standard vintage, practically indistinguishable from others unless one is especially interested in him. The mana of the mana personality is in the eyes of the beholder. The fascination is in the one who experiences it. This is the very thing that has to be explained. If all people are more or less alike, why do we burn with such all-consuming passions for some of them? What are we to make of the following report by a winner of the Miss Maryland contest, who describes her first meeting with Frank Sinatra, a crooner and film star who gained wealth and notoriety in the middle decades of the 20th century in the United States? "He was my date. I got a massage, and I must have taken 5 aspirins to calm myself down. In the restaurant, I saw him from across the room, and I got such butterflies in my stomach, and such a thing that went from head to toe. He had like a halo around his head of stars to me. He projected something I have never seen in my life. When I'm with him, I'm in awe, and I don't know why I can't snap out of it. I can't think. He's so fascinating." Imagine a scientific theory that could explain human slavishness by getting at its nexus. Imagine that after ages of laments about human folly, men would at last understand exactly why they were so fatally fascinated. Imagine being able to detail the precise causes of personal thraldom as coldly and as objectively as a chemist separates elements. When you imagine all these things, you will realize better than ever the world historical importance of psychoanalysis, which alone revealed this mystery. Freud saw that a patient in analysis developed a peculiarly intense attachment to the person of the analyst. The analyst became literally the center of his world and his life. He devoured him with his eyes. His heart swelled with joy at the sight of him. The analyst filled his thoughts even in his dreams. The whole fascination has the elements of an intense love affair. But it is not limited to women. Men show the same attachment to the physician, the same overestimation of his qualities, the same adoption of his interest, the same jealousy against all those connected with him. Freud saw that this was an uncanny phenomenon, and in order to explain it, he called it transference. The patient transfers the feelings he had toward his parents as a child to the person of the physician. He blows the physician up larger than life, just as the child sees the parents. He becomes as dependent on him, draws protection and power from him, just as the child merges his destiny with the parents, and so on. In the transference, we see the grown person as a child at heart, a child who distorts the world to relieve his helplessness and fears, who sees things as he wishes them to be for his own safety, who acts automatically and uncritically, just as he did in the pre-Oedipal period. Freud saw that transference was just another form of the basic human suggestibility that makes hypnosis possible. It was the same passive surrender to superior power, and in this lay its real uncanniness. What, after all, is more mysterious than hypnosis, the sight of adults falling into instant stupors and obeying like automatons the commands of a stranger? It seems like some truly supernatural power at work, as if some person really did possess a mana that could enmesh others in a spell. However, it seemed that way only because man ignored the slavishness in his own soul. He wanted to believe that if he lost his will, it was because of someone else. He wouldn't admit that this loss of will was something that he himself carried around as a secret yearning, a readiness to respond to someone's voice and the snap of his fingers. Hypnosis was a mystery only as long as man did not admit his own unconscious motives. It baffled us because we denied what was basic in our nature. Perhaps we could even say that men were all too willingly mystified by hypnosis because they had to deny the big lie upon which their whole conscious lives were based. The lie of self-sufficiency, of free self-determination, of independent judgment and choice. The continuing vogue of vampire movies may be a clue to how close to the surface our repressed fears are. The anxiety of losing control, of coming completely under someone's spell, of not really being in command of ourselves. One intense look, one mysterious song, and our lives may be lost forever. All this was brought out beautifully by Ferenczi in 1909, in a basic essay that has not been much improved upon in a half-century of psychoanalytic work. Note: I am aware of the enormous literature on transference and the extensions, modifications, and debates raging around it. But it would go far beyond my purposes to attempt to reflect the technical literature here. We will see further on some of the crucial ways in which our understanding of transference goes beyond Freud and Ferenczi. But I am not sure that the technical arguments among psychoanalysts on the precise nature of transference, hypnosis, and the like add much to their basic understanding of the phenomenon. Trigent Burrow's early attempt to make transference entirely a problem of social learning seems to me a clear fallacy, as we will see further on. Trigent Burrow, The Problem of the Transference, British Journal of Medical Psychology, 1927, Volume 7, pages 193 to 202. Freud seems to me still correct to discount physiological theories of induction into the hypnotic trance, in spite of Kuby and Margolin's later argument. Freud, Group Psychology and the Analysis of the Ego, 1922, New York, Bantam Books Edition, 1960, page 74, and L.S. Kuby and Sidney Margolin, The Process of Hypnotism and the Nature of the Hypnotic State, American Journal of Psychiatry, 1944, volume 180, pages 611 to 622. Also, Merton M. Gill and Margaret Brenman, Hypnosis and Related States, Psychoanalytic Studies in Regression, New York, Science Editions, 1959, pages 143 and 196 to 97. The area where the most meaningful revision of the theory of the transference has been made is, of course, its use and interpretation in therapy. And this is clearly outside my discussion. End of note. Ferenczi pointed out how important it was for the hypnotist to be an imposing person, of high social rank, with a self-confident manner. When he gave his commands, the patient would sometimes go under as if struck by coup de foudre. There was nothing to do but obey, as by his imposing authoritarian figure, the hypnotist took the place of the parents. He knew just those ways of frightening and being tender, the efficacy of which has been proved for thousands of years in the relations of parent to child. We see the same technique used by revivalists, as they alternatingly harangue their audiences with a shrieking voice, and then immediately soothe them with a soft one. With a heart-rending scream of agony and ecstasy, one throws himself at the revivalist's feet to be saved. As the highest ambition of the child is to obey the all-powerful parent, to believe in him and to imitate him, what is more natural than an instant imaginary return to childhood via the hypnotic trance? The explanation of the ease of hypnosis, said Ferenczi, is that in our innermost soul we are still children, and we remain so throughout life. And so, in one theoretical sweep, Ferenczi could destroy the mystery of hypnosis by showing that the subject carries in himself the predisposition to it. There is no such thing as a hypnotizing, a giving of ideas in the sense of physical incorporating of something quite foreign from without, but only procedures that are able to set going unconscious, pre-existing, auto-suggestive mechanisms. According to this conception, the application of suggestion and hypnosis consists in the deliberate establishment of conditions under which the tendency to blind belief and uncritical obedience present in everyone, but usually kept repressed, may unconsciously be transferred to the person hypnotizing or suggesting. I am lingering on Ferenczi's unlocking of the secret of hypnosis for a very important reason. By discovering a universal predisposition at the heart of man, Freudian psychology itself gained the key to a universal underlying historical psychology. As not everyone undergoes formal hypnosis, most people can hide and disguise their inner urge to merge themselves with power figures. But the predisposition to hypnosis is the same one that gives rise to transference, and no one is immune to that. No one can argue away the manifestations of transference in everyday human affairs. It is not visible on the surface. adults walk around looking quite independent. They play the role of parent themselves, and seem quite grown up, and so they are. They couldn't function if they still carried with them the childhood feeling of awe for their parents, the tendency to obey them automatically and uncritically. But, says Ferenczi, although these things normally disappear, the need to be subject to someone remains. Only the part of the father is transferred to teachers, superiors, impressive personalities. The submissive loyalty to rulers that is so widespread is also a transference of this sort. Freud's great work on group psychology. With a theoretical background that unlocked the problem of hypnosis and that discovered the universal mechanism of the transference, Freud was almost obliged to provide the best insights ever into the psychology of leadership. And so he wrote his great work, Group Psychology and the Analysis of the Ego, a book of fewer than 100 pages that, in my opinion, is probably the single most potentially liberating tract that has ever been fashioned by man. In his later years, Freud wrote a few books that reflected personal and ideological preferences. But group psychology was a serious scientific work that consciously placed itself in a long tradition. Early theorists of group psychology had tried to explain why men were so sheep-like when they functioned in groups. They developed ideas like mental contagion and herd instinct, which became very popular. But as Freud was quick to see, these ideas never really did explain what men did with their judgment and common sense when they got caught up in groups. Freud saw right away what they did with it. They simply became dependent children again, blindly following the inner voice of their parents, which now came to them under the hypnotic spell of the leader. They abandoned their egos to his, identified with his power, tried to function with him as an ideal. It is not so much that man is a herd animal, said Freud, but that he is a horde animal led by a chief. It is this alone that can explain the uncanny and coercive characteristics of group formations. The chief is a dangerous personality, toward whom only a passive masochistic attitude is possible, to whom one's will has to be surrendered, while to be alone with him, to look him in the face, appears a hazardous enterprise. This alone, says Freud, explains the paralysis that exists in the link between a person with inferior power to one of superior power. Man has an extreme passion for authority, and wishes to be governed by unrestricted force. It is this trait that the leader hypnotically embodies in his own masterful person. Or, as Fennekel later put it, people have a longing for being hypnotized, precisely because they want to get back to the magical protection, the participation in omnipotence, the oceanic feeling that they enjoyed when they were loved and protected by their parents. And so, as Freud argues, it is not that groups bring out anything new in people. It is just that they satisfy the deep-seated erotic longings that people constantly carry around unconsciously. For Freud, this was the life force that held groups together. It functioned as a kind of psychic cement that locked people into mutual and mindless interdependence, the magnetic powers of the leader, reciprocated by the guilty delegation of everyone's will to him. No one who honestly remembers how hazardous it could be to look certain people in the face, or how blissful to bask trustingly in the glow of another's power, can accuse Freud of psychoanalytic rhetoric. By explaining the precise power that held groups together, Freud could also show why groups did not fear danger. The members do not feel that they are alone with their own smallness and helplessness, as they have the powers of the hero leader with whom they are identified. Natural narcissism, the feeling that the person next to you will die, but not you, is reinforced by trusting dependence on the leader's power. No wonder that hundreds of thousands of men marched up from trenches in the face of blistering gunfire in World War I. They were partially self-hypnotized, so to speak. No wonder men imagine victories against impossible odds. Don't they have the omnipotent powers of the parental figure? Why are groups so blind and stupid? Men have always asked. Because they demand illusions, answered Freud. They constantly give what is unreal precedence over what is real. And we know why. The real world is simply too terrible to admit. It tells man that he is a small, trembling animal who will decay and die. Illusion changes all this, makes man seem important, vital to the universe, immortal in some way. Who transmits this illusion if not the parents by imparting the macro lie of the cultural casus belli? The masses look to the leaders to give them just the untruth that they need. The leader continues the illusions that triumph over the castration complex and magnifies them into a truly heroic victory. Furthermore, he makes possible a new experience, the expression of forbidden impulses, secret wishes, and fantasies. In group behavior, anything goes because the leader okays it. It is like being an omnipotent infant again, encouraged by the parent to indulge oneself plentifully, or like being in psychoanalytic therapy where the analyst doesn't censor you for anything you feel or think. In the group, each man seems an omnipotent hero, who can give full vent to his appetites under the approving eye of the father. And so we understand the terrifying sadism of group activity. Thus, Freud's great work on group psychology, on the dynamics of blind obedience, illusion, communal sadism. In recent writings, Eric Fromm especially has seen the durable value of Freud's insights as part of a developing and continuing critique of human viciousness and blindness. From his early work, Escape from Freedom, to his recent The Heart of Man, Fromm has developed Freud's views on the need for a magic helper. He has kept alive Freud's basic insight into narcissism as the primary characteristic of man, how it inflates one with the importance of his own life and makes for the devaluation of others' lives, how it helps to draw sharp lines between those who are like me or belong to me and those who are outsiders and aliens. Fromm has insisted, too, on the importance of what he calls incestuous symbiosis, the fear of emerging out of the family and into the world on one's own responsibility and powers, the desire to keep oneself tucked into a larger source of power. It is these things that make for the mystique of group, nation, blood, mother or fatherland, and the like. These feelings are embedded in one's earliest experiences of comfortable merger with the mother. As Fromm put it, they keep one in the prison of the motherly, racial, national, religious fixation. Fromm is exciting reading, and there is no point in my repeating or developing what he has already so well said. One has to go directly to him and study how compelling are these insights, how well they continue what is essential in Freud, and apply it to present-day problems of slavishness, viciousness, and continuing political madness. This, it seems to me, is the authentic line of cumulative critical thought on the human condition. The astonishing thing is that this central line of work on the problem of freedom since the Enlightenment occupies so little of the concern and ongoing activity of scientists. It should form the largest body of theoretical and empirical work in the human sciences if these sciences are to have any human meaning. Developments beyond Freud. Today, we do not accept uncritically all of Freud's arguments on group dynamics, or consider them necessarily complete. One of the weaknesses of Freud's theory was that he was too fond of his own phylogenetic myth of the primal horde, Freud's attempt to reconstruct the earliest beginnings of society when proto-men, like baboons, lived under the tyrannical rule of a dominant male. For Freud, this craving of people for the strong personality, their awe and fear of him, remained the model for the basic functioning of all groups. It was Redl, in his important essay, who showed that Freud's attempt to explain everything by the strong personality was not true to fact. Redl, who studied many different kinds of groups, found that domination by a strong personality occurred in some of them, but not all. But he did find that in all groups, there was what he called a central person, who held the group together due to certain of his qualities. This shift of emphasis is slight and leaves Freud basically intact, but it allows us to make more subtle analyses of the real dynamics of groups. For example, Freud found that the leader allows us to express forbidden impulses and secret wishes. Redl saw that in some groups, there is indeed what he perfectly calls the infectiousness of the unconflicted person. There are leaders who seduce us because they do not have the conflicts that we have. We admire their equanimity where we feel shame and humiliation. Freud saw that the leader wipes out fear and permits everyone to feel omnipotent. Redl refined this somewhat by showing how important the leader often was by the simple fact that it was he who performed the initiatory act, when no one else had the daring to do it. Redl calls this beautifully the magic of the initiatory act. This initiatory act can be anything from swearing to sex or murder. As Redl points out, according to its logic, only the one who first commits murder is the murderer. All others are followers. Freud has said in Totem and Taboo that acts that are illegal for the individual can be justified if the whole group shares responsibility for them. But they can be justified in another way. The one who initiates the act takes upon himself both the risk and the guilt. The result is truly magic. Each member of the group can repeat the act without guilt. They are not responsible, only the leader is. Rettle calls this aptly priority magic. But it does something even more than relieve guilt. It actually transforms the fact of murder. This crucial point initiates us directly into the phenomenology of group transformation of the everyday world. If one murders without guilt, and in imitation of the hero who runs the risk, why then it is no longer murder. It is holy aggression. For the first one, it was not. In other words, participation in the group redistills everyday reality and gives it the aura of the sacred, just as in childhood, play created a heightened reality. This penetrating vocabulary of initiatory acts, the infectiousness of the unconflicted person, priority magic, and so on, allows us to understand more subtly the dynamics of group sadism, the utter equanimity with which groups kill. It is not just that Father permits it or orders it. It is more, the magical heroic transformation of the world and of oneself. This is the illusion that man craves, as Freud said, and that makes the central person so effective a vehicle for group emotion. I am not going to repeat or sum up the subtleties of Rettle's essay here. Let us just underline the brunt of his argument, which is that the spell cast by persons, as we have called it, is a very complex one, which includes many more things than meet the eye. In fact, it may include everything but a spell. Rettle showed that groups use leaders for several types of exculpation or relief of conflict, for love, or for even just the opposite, targets of aggression and hate that pulls the group together in a common bond. As one recent popular film advertisement put it, they follow him bravely into hell, only for the pleasure of killing him and revenging themselves. Rettle was not out to replace Freud's basic insights, but only to extend and add nuances to them. The instructive thing about his examples is that most of the central person's functions do have to do with guilt, expiation, and unambiguous heroics. The important conclusion for us is that groups use the leader sometimes with little regard for him personally, but always with regard to fulfilling their own needs and urges. W. R. Bion, in an important recent paper, extended this line of thought even further from Freud, arguing that the leader is as much a creature of the group as they of him, and that he loses his individual distinctiveness by being a leader, as they do by being followers. He has no more freedom to be himself than any other member of the group, precisely because he has to be a reflex of their assumptions in order to qualify for leadership in the first place. All of which leads us to muse wistfully on how unheroic is the average man, even when he follows heroes. He simply loads them up with his own baggage. He follows them with reservations, with a dishonest heart. The noted psychoanalyst Paul Schilder had already observed that man goes into the hypnotic trance itself with reservations. He said penetratingly that it was this fact that deprived hypnosis of the profound seriousness which distinguishes every truly great passion. And so he called it timid, because it lacked the great free, unconditional surrender. I think this characterization is beautifully apt to describe the timid heroisms of group behavior. There is nothing free or manly about them. Even when one merges his ego with the authoritarian father, the spell is in his own narrow interests. People use their leaders almost as an excuse. When they give in to the leader's commands, they can always reserve the feeling that these commands are alien to them, that they are the leader's responsibility, that the terrible acts they are committing are in his name and not theirs. This, then, is another thing that makes people feel so guiltless, as Canetti points out. They can imagine themselves as temporary victims of the leader. The more they give in to his spell, and the more terrible the crimes they commit, the more they can feel that the wrongs are not natural to them. It is all so neat, this usage of the leader. It reminds us of James Frazer's discovery that in the remote past, tribes often used their kings as scapegoats, who, when they no longer served the people's needs, were put to death. These are the many ways in which men can play the hero, all the while that they are avoiding responsibility for their own acts in a cowardly way. Very few people, for example, have been impressed with the recent heroics of the Manson family. When we look at them in the light of the group dynamics we have been discussing, we can understand better why we are shocked, not only by the gratuitous murders they committed, but by something more. When people try for heroics from the position of willing slavishness, there is nothing to admire. It is all so automatic, predictable, pathetic. Here was a group of young men and women who had identified with Charles Manson, and who lived in masochistic submission to him. They gave him their total devotion, and looked upon him as a human god of some kind. In fact, he filled the description of Freud's primal father. He was authoritarian, very demanding of his followers, and a great believer in discipline. His eyes were intense, and for those who came under his spell, there was no doubt that he projected a hypnotic aura. He was a very self-assured figure. He even had his own truth, his megalomaniac vision for taking over the world. To his followers, his vision seemed like a heroic mission in which they were privileged to participate. He had convinced them that only by following out his plan could they be saved. The family was very close, sexual inhibitions were non-existent, and members had free access to each other. They even used sex freely for the purpose of attracting outsiders into the family. It seems obvious from all this that Manson combined the fascinating effect of the narcissistic personality with the infectiousness of the unconflicted personality. Everyone could freely drop his repressions under Manson's example and command, not only in sex but in murder. The members of the family didn't seem to show any remorse, guilt, or shame for their crimes. People were astonished by this ostensible lack of human feeling. But from the dynamics that we have been surveying, we are faced with the even more astonishing conclusion that homicidal communities like the Manson family are not really devoid of basic humanness. What makes them so terrible is that they exaggerate the dispositions present in us all. Why should they feel guilt or remorse? The leader takes responsibility for the destructive act, and those who destroy on his command are no longer murderers, but holy heroes. They crave to serve in the powerful aura that he projects, and to carry out the illusion that he provides them, an illusion that allows them to heroically transform the world. Under his hypnotic spell, and with the full force of their own urges for heroic self-expansion, they need have no fear. They can kill with equanimity. In fact, they seem to feel that they were doing their victims a favor, which seems to mean that they sanctified them by including them in their own holy mission. As we have learned from the anthropological literature, the victim who is sacrificed becomes a holy offering to the gods, to nature, or to fate. The community gets more life by means of the victim's death, and so the victim has the privilege of serving the world in the highest possible way by means of his own sacrificial death. One direct way, then, of understanding homicidal communities like the Manson family is to view them as magical transformations, wherein passive and empty people, torn with conflicts and guilt, earn their cheap heroism, really feeling that they control fate and influence life and death. Cheap because not in their command, not with their own daring, and not in the grip of their own fears. Everything is done with the leader's image stamped on their psyche. The larger view of transference. From this discussion of transference, we can see one great cause of the large-scale ravages that man makes on the world. He is not just a naturally and lustily destructive animal who lays waste around him because he feels omnipotent and impregnable. Rather, he is a trembling animal who pulls the world down around his shoulders as he clutches for protection and support, and tries to affirm in a cowardly way his feeble powers. The qualities of the leader, then, and the problems of people, fit together in a natural symbiosis. I have lingered on a few refinements of group psychology, to show that the powers of the leader stem from what he can do for people, beyond the magic that he himself possesses. People project their problems onto him, which gives him his role and stature. Leaders need followers as much as they are needed by them. The leader projects onto his followers his own inability to stand alone, his own fear of isolation. We must say that if there were no natural leaders possessing the magic of charisma, men would have to invent them, just as leaders must create followers if there are none available. If we accent this natural symbiotic side of the problem of transference, we come into the broadest understanding of it, which forms the main part of the discussion I now want to dwell on. Note, now that we have sketched some of the highlights of the easy symbiosis of groups and leaders, we have to be careful not to leave a one-sided picture. There is another side to show, a very different one. The guilt of all the followers does not vanish so easily under the spell of a leader, no matter how much he takes upon himself or how godlike he seems. Not everyone can be equally caught up in identification with him, and not everyone's guilt is so easily overcome. Many people may feel deeply guilty if they violate long-standing and deep-felt moral codes on his behalf. Yet ironically, it is just this that puts them even more in the leader's power, makes them even more willing putty in his hands. If, as we have seen, the group comes ready-made to the leader with the thirst for servitude, he tries to deepen that servitude even further. If they seek to be free of guilt in his cause, he tries to load them up with an extra burden of guilt and fear to draw the mesh of his immorality around them. He gets a really coercive hold on the members of the group precisely because they follow his lead in committing outrageous acts. He can then use their guilt against them, binding them closer to himself. He uses their anxiety for his purposes, even arousing it as he needs to. And he can use their fear of being found out and revenged by their victims as a kind of blackmail that keeps them docile and obedient for further atrocities. We saw a classic example of this technique on the part of the Nazi leaders. It was the same psychology that criminal gangs and gangsters have always used, to be bound closer together through the crime itself. The Nazis called it blood cement, Blutkit, and the SS used it freely. For the lower echelons, service in the concentration camps accomplished this loyalty. But the technique was also used on the highest levels, especially with reluctant persons of prominence and talent whom they wanted to recruit. These they induced to commit extra atrocities that indelibly identified them with the SS and gave them a new criminal identity. See Leo Alexander's excellent paper, Sociopsychologic Structure of the SS, Archives of Neurology and Psychiatry, 1948-59, 622-634. And as the Nazi epoch wore on and the toll of victims mounted, the leaders played upon the fears of reprisal by those who would revenge the victims the Nazis had made. It was the old gangster trick, this time used to cement together a whole nation. Thus, what may begin as the heroic mission of a Hitler or a Manson comes to be sustained by bullying and threats, by added fear and guilt. The followers find that they have to continue on with a megalomaniac plan because it becomes their only chance of survival in a hostile world. The followers must do what the leader wants, which becomes what they themselves must want in order to survive. If the leader loses, they too perish. They cannot quit, nor does he allow them to. And so the German nation fought on until the final destruction of Berlin. The Manson family held together under persecution and his threats, to flee to the desert and await the end of the world. This gives an added dimension, too, to our understanding of why people stick with their leaders even in defeat, as the Egyptians did with Nasser. Without him, they may feel just too exposed to reprisal, to total annihilation. Having been baptized in his fire, they can no longer stand alone. On all this, see Ernst Chris, The Covenant of the Gangsters, Journal of Criminal Psychopathology, 1942-43, Chapter 4, 441-454. Paul Rosen, Freud, pages 238-242. T. W. Adorno, Freudian Theory and the Pattern of Fascist Propaganda, in Psychoanalysis and the Social Sciences, 1951, pages 298-300. And Ed Sanders, The Family, The Story of Charles Manson's Dune Buggy Attack Battalion, New York, Dutton, 1971, especially pages 145, 199, 257. End of note. Freud had already revealed as much about the problems of followers as about the magnetism of the leader when he taught us about the longing for transference and what it accomplished. But just here, trouble lies. As always, he showed us where to look, but focused down too narrowly. He had a conception, as Wolstein succinctly put it, of why man got into trouble, and his explanations of trouble almost always came to rest on the sexual motive. The fact that people were so prone to suggestibility in hypnosis was for him proof that it depended on sexuality. The transference attraction that we feel for people is merely a manifestation of the earliest attractions that the child felt for those around him. But now this purely sexual attraction is so buried in the unconscious that we don't realize what really motivates our fascinations. In Freud's unmistakable words, we have to conclude that all the feelings of sympathy, friendship, trust, and so forth, which we expend in life, are genetically connected with sexuality and have developed out of purely sexual desires by an enfeebling of their sexual aim, however pure and non-sensual they may appear in the forms they take on to our conscious self-perception. To begin with, we knew none but sexual objects. Psychoanalysis shows us that those persons whom in real life we merely respect or are fond of may be sexual objects to us in our unconscious mind still. We have already seen how this kind of reductionism to the sexual motive got psychoanalysis itself into trouble very early, and how it has taken a succession of thinkers of great stature to extricate psychoanalysis from this obsession of Freud's. But in his later work, Freud himself was not too troubled by his obsession when it came to explaining some things more broadly. The same holds true for his narrow sexual emphasis on transference surrender. In 1912, he said that the fact that transference could lead to complete subjection was for him unmistakable proof of its erotic character. But in his later work, when he accented more and more the terror of the human condition, he talked of the child's longing for a powerful father as a protection against strange superior powers, as a consequence of human weakness and childish helplessness. Yet this phrasing doesn't represent an absolute abandonment of his earlier explanations. For Freud, Eros covered not only specific sexual drives, but also the child's longing for omnipotence, for the oceanic feeling that comes with a merger with the parental powers. With this kind of generalization, Freud could have both his broader and narrower views at the same time. This complicated mixture of specific error and correct generalization has made it a difficult and lengthy task for us to separate out what is true from what is false in psychoanalytic theory. But as we said earlier with Rank, it seems fairly conclusive that if you accent the terrors of external nature, as Freud did in his later work, then you are talking about the general human condition and no longer about specific erotic drives. We might say that the child would then seek merger with the parental omnipotence, not out of desire, but out of cowardice. And now we are on wholly new terrain. The fact that transference could lead to complete subjection proves not its erotic character, but something quite different. Its truthful character, we might say. As Adler saw with complete clarity long before Freud's later work, transference is fundamentally a problem of courage. As we have learned conclusively from Rank and Brown, it is the immortality motive and not the sexual one that must bear the larger burden of our explanation of human passion. What does this crucial shift of emphasis mean for our understanding of transference? A truly fascinating and comprehensive view of the human condition. Transference as fetish control. If transference relates to cowardice, we can understand why it goes all the way back to childhood. It reflects the whole of the child's attempts to create an environment that will give him safety and satisfaction. He learns to act and to perceive his environment in such a way that he banishes anxiety from it. But now the fatality of transference. When you set up your perception-action world to eliminate what is basic to it, anxiety, then you fundamentally falsify it. This is why psychoanalysts have always understood transference as a regressive phenomenon, uncritical, wishful, a matter of automatic control of one's world. Silverberg gives a classic psychoanalytic definition. Transference indicates a need to exert complete control over external circumstances. In all its variety and multiplicity of manifestation, transference may be regarded as the enduring monument of man's profound rebellion against reality, and his stubborn persistence in the ways of immaturity. For Erich Fromm, transference reflects man's alienation. In order to overcome his sense of inner emptiness and impotence, man chooses an object onto whom he projects all his own human qualities, his love, intelligence, courage, etc. By submitting to this object, he feels in touch with his own qualities. He feels strong, wise, courageous, and secure. To lose the object means the danger of losing himself. This mechanism, idolatric worship of an object, based on the fact of the individual's alienation, is the central dynamism of transference, that which gives transference its strength and intensity. Jung's view was similar. Fascination with someone is basically a matter of always trying to deliver us into the power of a partner who seems compounded of all the qualities we have failed to realize in ourselves. And so was the Adlerian view. Transference is basically a maneuver or a tactic by which the patient seeks to perpetuate his familiar mode of existence that depends on a continuing attempt to divest himself of power and place it in the hands of the other. I am citing these several authorities at length for two reasons: to show the general truth of their insights, and also to be able, later on, to bring up the immense problems that these truths raise. Already we can see that transference is not a matter of unusual cowardice, but rather of the basic problems of an organismic life, problems of power and control. The